and welcome to the Science Podcast for May 2nd, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the neurons that drive young songbirds to babble, reversing the loss of sight with gene therapy, lung scans for cancer detection, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Just like human babies, young songbirds babble. In this week's Science, Michael Fee and colleagues describe how in zebra finches, that babbling is driven by a specialized brain circuitry that is not involved in how the adult birds sing. The research suggests that this specialized circuitry is involved in exploratory behaviors and that the developing vertebrate brain may include other components devoted specifically to youthful behavior. I spoke with Fee from his office at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
What we were interested in finding out is whether the brain areas that produce the song in an adult bird are actually the same as the brain areas that produce the very earliest sounds that young birds make. So young birds learn their song in a series of stages. They start out, just as humans do, by babbling. And here's what a babbling bird sounds like.
And what kind of bird is this?
The birds we work with are zebra finches.
And how does that compare to how the adult bird sounds like?
Okay, so here's what an adult bird sounds like.
Okay.
And the real difference that you can hear between these is that the adult bird produces a very precise, stereotyped pattern of sound. So in the adult bird song, you can hear this repeated motif, as we call it, da-da-da-dee, 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 da-da-da-dee. And every time he sings his song, he repeats that motif over and over and over again. And he repeats it extremely precisely. And here again, for contrast, is what the babbler sounds like. So you can hear the difference is that the babbling bird doesn't have this very precise repeated sound. In fact, what he does is quite random. It's very hard to find any two pieces of the babbling song that actually sound the same.
So are different brain regions involved in making these two different types of sounds?
In fact, they are. So what we have found is that a particular part of the brain in the adult bird acts very much like a clock that produces this very precise stereotype sequence of sounds in the adult bird. And in fact, in juvenile birds, that clock-like part of the brain is not even necessary for producing the babbling sounds of the juvenile, the young bird song. Now, that wasn't so obvious from the beginning, because you could imagine that the babbling sounds are simply produced by an immature form of the circuitry that then produces the stereotype song of the adult bird.
How does this fit within developmental learning models?
Well, one of the most influential models of motor learning has been the view that in the juvenile brain, there are many, many circuits that produce many different behaviors, and those circuits compete with each other in some way during development, and one of those circuits ends up winning out to produce the adult behavior. One of the predictions then is that those same circuits that produce the adult song should still be there in the juvenile. It should be one of those many circuits that are competing with each other. In fact, what we found is that some parts of the brain that are involved in producing the adult song are not even necessary for producing this juvenile song. And that's what really led us to then look for a different part of the brain that's involved in producing the babbling.
Is there sort of an in-between stage that is happening between the young babbling and the adult song?
There is an in-between stage. So what we think happens is that in a young bird, at the very earliest stage of producing his song, at the babbling stage, there's one area that's actually responsible for producing the sort of random patterns of activity that drive that babbling. And in the adult bird, that babbling circuit seems to be suppressed or much less important in its function. And this other clock-like area takes over in the adult bird. And what we think is that as the bird is learning his song, control of singing gradually transfers from this babbling-like area to the clock-like area. And so what you find is that in young birds at an intermediate age that have halfway learned their song, that the song has some of this stereotyped repeated pattern, but it's also highly variable.
Let's hear what that sounds like.
Okay, so the song of a bird in this intermediate stage, which we call plastic song, sounds like this. And in this plastic song stage, you can hear some of the variability of the babbling song, which again sounds like this, and some of the stereotypy of the adult song, which again sounds like this.
How did your team go about figuring out that these different parts of the brain were active in young bird babbling versus adult singing?
Well, it turns out that we got to this by actually a rather circuitous route where we were investigating something completely different about the role of HVC during learning.
HVC is that?
HVC is this high vocal center, which is this area that is what I've been referring to as the clock-like area that seems to be responsible for producing the precise timing. And we were inactivating this area for completely different reasons when we discovered that adult and younger birds, in fact, started babbling after we inactivated HVC. What we found is that at any age, when we inactivate HVC, the song becomes like babbling.
Are there other possible explanations for why the adult birds reverted to this babbling after having part of their brain inactivated?
Well, so scientists have been inactivating this area, HVC, for a long time to try to figure out what it does. And in fact, a long time ago, researchers have noticed that when you inactivate HVC, the song looks quite variable and quite noisy. The interpretation had always been that the manipulations they were doing in HVC were somehow leaving that circuit malfunctioning rather than inactivated. What we decided to find out is if this other part of the circuit might actually be producing these babbling sounds. So this other part of the circuit is called the lateral magnocellular nucleus of the nidopallium, which we thankfully have shorthand for. We just call it LMAN. What we decided to look at is whether this LMAN is actually driving the motor circuit to produce the babbling sounds. Now, in order to really nail this down, in order to be absolutely sure that LMAN is producing this babbling, we recorded from individual neurons in this nucleus while the bird is babbling, in a young bird that's babbling, and we found that these neurons generate a big burst of activity 10 to 15 milliseconds before each one of these babbling sounds. Exactly how long it takes for signals from LMAN to reach the vocal organ. In other words, what we found is that not only is LMAN necessary for producing babbling, but we found that the neurons in LMAN are active immediately before the babbling sounds.
So how widely into the animal kingdom does this idea apply, that different specialized brain regions are involved in babbling versus adult songs or other sounds?
Well, I think that our experiments are really the first to look at this question of where in the brain the circuits are that generate early vocalizations in young animals. Now, people have looked at how early movements, how spontaneous movements in very young animals are involved in developing the nervous system. Well, what's been found in other systems is that spontaneous movements in young animals, like muscle twitches, are involved in establishing that mapping, that the brain really learns how to use its body by making spontaneous movements and just seeing what happens.
So the babbling is just sort of then a spontaneous twitching of the vocal cords.
Exactly. That's exactly correct. And what I like to think is that this is just another example of a behavior that nearly all animals do, play. That babbling in songbirds is just an example of play. It's vocal play.
Michael Fee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Fee, a senior author of a paper on the specialized circuitry for babbling in the juvenile songbird. Read the paper in this week's Science. Next weekend, May 9th through 11th, researchers will hold a unique scientific conference that involves no travel, no conference center, and no hotels. Instead, this conference will be held inside a virtual world. That's incorporates music from the world of Warcraft, the virtual world in which scientists will gather as represented by their virtual selves. Gonzo scientist John Bohannon proposed the conference after reading an article by sociologist William Sims Bainbridge this past summer in Science about the research potential in virtual worlds.
And it just so happens that over the past year and a half, I've become a big gamer in online worlds, mostly because it's the only way that I can keep in touch with my family back in the States. And we find that killing monsters together while talking online is a great way to keep in touch.
Conference attendees also will kill monsters together. Conference organizer William Sims Bainbridge from the National Science Foundation says that he and Bohannon will do their best to keep attendees from getting virtually killed. You can always come back again. But invites those who haven't experienced World of Warcraft to get online now to start getting some practice.
While we've staged three expeditions after the three sessions that will give newcomers a lot of experience, we've especially selected areas that would be relatively safe for them.
The conference sessions include research inside virtual worlds, relationships between virtual worlds and the real world, and the future of virtual worlds. To be a part of the conference, Bohannon says simply sign up within World of Warcraft to a particular guild.
The name of the guild is Science, so that's easy enough. And my character's name is Gonzarina. She's now a 22nd level troll huntress. And she has a pet named Darwin, so I'm easy to spot.
Bainbridge, as organizer, has several characters, each in different roles. But he says that the most he'll be handling is two at a time.
We have one character called Science Mag. She was created especially for this, and so that the souvenir red t-shirts would say made by Science Mag on them. The symbol on our guild tabard is an infinity sign. And we're feeling very scientific about it all.
You can learn more about the first ever scientific conference within World of Warcraft online at convergentsystems.pbwiki.com. Two independent teams of researchers announced this week that they have partially restored the sight of four young adults born with severe blindness. In this week's Science, news writer Jocelyn Kaiser reports on the science of gene therapy that was used to treat the study participants.
My article is about two studies that were just published in the New England Journal of Medicine about using gene therapy to treat inherited blindness. And in these two separate small studies, a total of six patients were given a gene therapy treatment for the first time, and the patients who had varying degrees of blindness before they were treated, four of them could see better after the treatment. They could sense more light, and a couple of them were better at navigating an obstacle course.
What is gene therapy? How does it work?
Gene therapy is a kind of medicine that attempts to correct mistakes in genes that lead to disease. So what scientists do is they take a harmless virus and add a form of the correct gene to the virus, inject it into the cells of a patient, and the gene then starts producing a protein that corrects the problem that led to the disease.
So there was a very particular reason behind why these people were blind that was corrected through
these people were born with a mutation in a particular gene involved in how the eyes process or sense light. And so they started going blind when they were born and have gotten more blind throughout their lives. They're now anywhere from, I think, 17 to 26. And while some of them could see to some degree, like they could maybe walk down a street without a blind cane, but they might need help to make sure they didn't bump into things.
Now, it sounds like from the method you described of gene therapy that it could be applied for a number of different ailments or diseases that are caused by malfunctioning genes. Why focus on this particular type of blindness?
Researchers have been interested in using gene therapy in the eye because it is a kind of confined organ, so you don't have to try to get the gene into other cells in the body, unlike with some other diseases. And so it should be easier in a way than, for example, trying to correct some defect in the liver or in the blood.
So by confined, it means that those proteins that are generated by the genes in the eye are only going to show up there?
Right. Well, they don't need to try to get the gene into a lot of different tissues. They only need to get it into the eye, which for one thing should be safer, because if you have to get the gene into more tissues, you might have to inject it into the bloodstream, and that could lead to an immune response. But since it only has to stay in the eye, it's less likely that there's going to be some kind of immune response.
Now, this is a very small study. You said only 6 patients.
Right.
Is there some concern about safety, that this hasn't become sort of a widespread treatment, or they didn't start with more people?
Right. Yeah, they had tested this gene therapy in mice and also in dogs about 7 years ago. They showed that it helped correct blindness in 3 dogs, the special breed Briard dogs that carry the mutation. And since that, they've tried it on something like 50 dogs successfully, but they had not tried it in a person. And whenever you test something new in a person, you have to be very careful about safety. So they started with a low dose, and a couple of the studies deliberately started with adults because they, even though the disease starts early in childhood, they thought it would be safer to start with adults.
So what's next then? Is it to move it to children trials or widespread among adults who have this condition?
So the next step in these 2 trials is to test the treatment in younger subjects. One of them has just treated an 8-year-old. And so because young children have more intact cells in their retina, they have a healthier retina, the chances are that it's going to work even better.
So these were the results of 2 different trials. Are there any other trials that would confirm these findings?
There is a 3rd study going on that began about the same time as one of these studies that have just been published. It's sponsored by the National Eye Institute, but the Eye Institute has not yet reviewed the data to make sure they're comfortable with a publication on the results. But that will probably be coming in the next few weeks or months.
Well, Jocelyn Kaiser, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Rob.
Science News writer Jocelyn Kaiser reports on the success of gene therapy to partially restore sight. You can read her article in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, twisted nanowires. Matthew Bierman and colleagues at the University of Wisconsin-Madison have grown lead sulfide nanowires that are twisted in such a way as to resemble pine trees. The hierarchical pattern structure has a main trunk and branches that spiral around the trunk like a helical staircase. The shape comes from a single screw-like dislocation along the trunk, and making the wires requires no catalyst or template. The research may yield new pathways for building nanoelectronics, nanooptics, and biotechnology. You can read the paper at www.scienceexpress.org. The science of detecting lung cancer has gotten a lot more sophisticated. New computer tomography or CT scans provide a lot more resolution than the traditional X-ray, but as Science Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall reports, the medical community is divided over whether screening with CT scans decreases the risk of death from lung cancer as compared with standard X-ray scans.
This article is about a disagreement among clinicians who treat lung cancer about whether it's possible to identify small lung tumors early and thereby save lives. It's focused on methods for what they call screening for lung cancer, which means taking people who don't have symptoms but are at risk, smokers especially, for getting lung cancer, and giving a simple test that will identify lung cancer before it becomes metastatic. The disagreement is about whether this can be done effectively and will end up doing more benefit than harm. The methods that they were discussing, there are many methods that are considered, but in this case, we're looking at a high-tech new method of X-ray imaging that combines computers with very sophisticated methods of emitting and capturing the X-ray signal. These devices are called CT, or computed tomography, imaging machines, and they, in the last decade, they've become incredibly sophisticated.
How likely are these to produce a false positive or a false negative, in which the test gives you the opposite result of what's actually true?
Well, the CT imaging device is a wonderful machine because it can see so much more than you could in the past with a standard chest X-ray. You can see very small growths. They now resolve an object as small as a third of a centimeter squared. The benefit is you get to see lots more, but that's also the problem. You see more than you want to see. You get a lot of artifactual material, noise, and the challenge is to remove the noise from the signal and only respond to the really serious indications of tumors.
So what then exactly is the harm of screening people using these CT scans?
Well, the risk is you do get a lot of false positives. So initially, it would trigger a sort of a note of concern. The patient would be told, well, we've seen something in your CT scan. We need to find out what it is. So yes, the first thing is that the patient is going to be concerned. They're told you might have a very dangerous cancer. That leads to further testing, imaging, repeated scanning, and of course, every time you get scanned, you're being exposed to ionizing radiation from the X-ray source, which is not good. may lead to biopsy, which is a surgical procedure to take a sample of the lung tissue, even surgery.
So widespread use of this would just multiply those bad effects across the entire population of people who might be at risk, like all the smokers.
You could imagine that there would be a great increase in medical procedures if this technology were widely used for screening. There's 45 million smokers in the United States. All of them are good candidates for screening for lung cancer because they're all at elevated risk. So yes, you would see, first of all, many more people coming in for screening, which maybe cost $200 or $300, but that's followed by all sorts of medical tests and procedures, ultimately possibly leading to lung surgery. And you don't really know, without very careful examination of medical results, whether that lung surgery was needed.
To those advocating the widespread use of these CT scans, what's their evidence that the screening reduces the risk of death from lung cancer compared with the standard X-ray scans?
Standard X-ray scans are now pretty well acknowledged to be a very poor tool for catching lung cancer early. The disagreement is just about how well CT scans work. And there's one major study that's gotten a lot of attention that was published in 2006, but has continued to be discussed and debated by a group at Cornell Weill Medical College in New York. They found reported a lot of good results, but the most striking one to me is that they found that among people who were identified with stage one lung cancer, that's the earliest stage where you have a good chance of removing it if you get it early, 88% of the people that they identified at that stage were alive a decade later. Now that's remarkable because the regular statistic is that if you're diagnosed with lung cancer in 5 years, only 15% of those people will still be alive. So that was a very strong indication that they're able to detect cancers early, and remove cancers, and avoid a metastatic spread.
But there are some problems with this study. Some controversy, you said, still going on?
The study is controversial because they decided early in the study that they would not have a control arm. That is, it's simply a study of screening and treating people. There's no group that was left with, say, a less intensive treatment, so there's no comparator. That's a flaw. Many of the people who have examined the study have said that it's vulnerable to bias. It's likely to be affected by the wishes of the study leaders to have good results, not intentionally, but just because of the nature of studies drift in that way. So that, yes, it's been criticized for having a built-in bias. Now, one reason they had no comparator arm, as I understand it, is that they thought it would not be good to use chest X-ray as a comparison, and they felt it would be unethical not to offer some treatment or some technology for screening. They decided that they would use the best available and only the best available and not leave any of their patients, their volunteers, to fend for themselves with chest X-ray. They did early on try chest X-ray as an alternate screening technology, and they found that among the cancers that were detected by screening, that is, the CT or chest X-ray missed 76%. So they felt it was wrong to use it.
Well, is anyone conducting a randomized trial to test whether CT scans do, in fact, reduce the risk of death from lung cancer as compared with X-ray or anything else?
Yes, because of this disagreement in the community about whether, you know, technology was ripe for wider use, the National Cancer Institute began a major test, clinical trial. In fact, it's the largest screening trial it's ever conducted. It's called the National Lung Screening Trial. It's costing $200 million at least, maybe more. And they're looking at two groups of people, one group with CT screening and the other group with chest X-ray. So they were willing to include people in a chest X-ray arm. And the study has completed screening for 50,000 people, and they've begun to sort of tabulate the statistics. They won't know until probably 2010 whether CT screening proved to be better than chest X-ray in terms of preventing death from lung cancer, catching it early, and enabling people to have surgery and avoid death.
Presumably making the advocates for CT scanning a little upset at the slow time frame.
Yes, there is an outspoken advocacy group called the Lung Cancer Alliance, which has been pushing very hard for getting screening with CT scanning started in any government program that they can persuade to get it going. But so far, the professional organizations, government have held off and said that we want to see the results of this major clinical trial before we give any national approval to CT use for lung cancer screening.
Elliot Marshall, thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Science Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall reports on scanning for lung cancer. You can read his article in this week's Science. Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about why mothers who eat breakfast are more likely to have boy children, the dangers of fake blood, And finally, the possibility that an oil field explosion did in the dinosaurs.
Well, let's start with why mothers who eat breakfast are more likely to have boy children. I didn't know that diet could affect a baby's gender.
Well, Rob, it's a controversial theory, but something's needed to explain the almost 40,000 missing boys in the United States since the 1970s.
Missing? How are they missing?
Well, they're missing in the sense that since 1970, researchers have noticed a 0.1% drop in the number of male births in the U.S. Now, that may not sound like much, but like I just said, it actually results in about 40,000 fewer boys than you would expect. And researchers have proposed all sorts of mechanisms why this might be the case. A lot of them have blamed environmental contaminants. Maybe there's something that gets into the womb that prevents babies from becoming boys. But the jury's still out. But there's one interesting theory that has to do with nutrition. And this goes back to a theory proposed by a couple of biologists in the 1970s. And they theorized that in the wild, it would be a good idea for mothers to have some control over the sex of their offspring.
Why is that?
Well, if a mother is healthy and she has access to a lot of food, it makes more sense for her to have male offspring. And that's because males can produce more progeny than females. But if a mother doesn't have access to as much food, she's better off passing on her genes if she gives birth to a female rather than a mediocre male that may not be able to sire a lot of offspring.
So evolutionary-wise, it's better either to have healthy males or females, but no mediocre males.
Exactly. And so researchers wondered, does the same thing happen in humans? So a team that was thinking about these tens of thousands of lost boys did a random sample of over 700 pregnant women in England. And these women didn't know what the sex of their baby was going to be, but they filled out these very detailed surveys about what they were eating each day. And it turns out, just as has been theorized in the wild, that women that consumed more calories gave birth to more boys. In fact, mothers that consumed the highest amount of calories were 56% likely to give birth to boy children versus mothers in the low-calorie group who only 45% of the time gave birth to male children. And what was most interesting is that this effect correlated very strongly with how much the women ate for breakfast. Moms who had at least one bowl of cereal per day were 59% likely to give birth to boys versus 43% of women who ate less than a bowl a week.
Why did researchers look at cereal in particular?
Well, other studies have shown that breakfast is particularly important for maintaining blood sugar levels. And blood sugar levels have been linked to the increased production of males in other mammals. So it makes sense.
What are other researchers saying about the results of this study?
Well, some researchers are really excited about this. They say it's the first direct evidence that something similar is happening in humans as might be happening in animals in the wild in terms of determining sex ratios. But other researchers say you can't discount the effect of environmental contaminants or a number of other factors.
Well, then, from the multiple factors determining a child's sex to the multiple factors that make substitute blood different from real blood, how is fake blood dangerous?
Well, Rob, when we're talking about fake blood here, we're obviously not talking about the blood used in movies. We're talking about blood that's used as a substitute when real blood isn't available. And that actually happens with surprising frequency. Blood goes bad very quickly, and a lot of hospitals have short supplies on hand. So for decades, researchers have been trying to develop fake blood or substitute blood. And none of these products have entered general circulation or been approved, but they are being used occasionally in clinical trials to see whether they're effective. And some research indicates that these products may actually be harmful to people, but nobody's really taken an overall view of all the products that were out there and tried to assess generally how dangerous they are.
How many different types of fake blood are there?
Well, the researchers in this study looked at 5 different types of fake blood, and they compiled data from 16 clinical trials. They pulled it all together, and what they found was that people that received fake blood had a 30% increased risk of dying after they received the fake blood versus people that received normal blood. And what was even more dramatic is the people that received fake blood were almost 3 times more likely to suffer heart attacks than people that didn't receive fake blood.
Do researchers know why that's happening?
Well, no one really knows what's behind the difference, but one theory has to do with hemoglobin. These fake blood products are sort of hemoglobin-based, and hemoglobin helps carry oxygen throughout the body, which is why it's used in fake blood. But this team wonders whether hemoglobin might also bind up nitrogen oxide molecules. And normally, nitrogen oxide helps dilate blood vessels and keeps platelets from getting sticky. So you can imagine if it's sequestered by hemoglobin, it's not having its effect in the body, and blood vessels may constrict, and clots might form more easily, leading to heart attacks and death.
So the hemoglobin in the fake blood operates perhaps in a different way than the hemoglobin does in real blood.
That's one possibility.
So is that prompting researchers to stop clinical trials on humans and move back into animals?
Well, that's what this team suggests. It doesn't suggest abandoning fake blood, because obviously it can be very important. But they suggest taking a step back, stop doing trials in humans, and do them in animals instead to figure out what the potential dangers are. Although not all experts agree with the study, some criticize the researchers for lumping together a number of different types of fake blood, some of which have already been shown to be ineffective, and they say that could bias the data and make newer products look more ineffective or even harmful than they actually are.
Well, from the potential toxicity of substitute blood to the potential toxicity of the atmosphere in the Cretaceous period that may have led to the end of the dinosaurs. How did an oil field explosion do in the dinosaurs?
Well, Rob, one of the most popular theories right now for what killed the dinosaur was an asteroid impact. And scientists suspect an asteroid for two reasons. First of all, they found a layer of iridium at what's called the KT boundary. And this is a layer of Earth deposited about 65 million years ago that corresponds to about the time that the dinosaurs died off. And iridium is important because it's not very common on Earth, but it is very common in asteroids. They've also found what they think is the site of the impact, which is a crater called Chicxulub, if I'm saying that correctly, on the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico.
What's this got to do with oil fields?
Well, what it has to do with oil fields is, even though the asteroid impact is a popular theory, a lot of scientists say it doesn't fully explain why the dinosaurs died out. One hypothesis is that the impact caused huge forest fires, which filled the sky with smoke and blocked out the sun and caused global warming and potentially even killed the plants that the herbivorous dinosaurs were eating. But the problem with that hypothesis is there's only a few traces of charred plant remains at the KT boundary, so it suggests that there might be something else going on. So the oil field hypothesis goes like this. This region of Mexico was once host and is still host to huge underground oil reservoirs. And the idea is if this asteroid struck this oil reservoir, it would have ignited a huge fireball hundreds of kilometers wide.
So the fire wasn't with the plants, it was with the oil.
Exactly.
What's the evidence for that?
Well, looking in these KT sediments at about 8 of 13 locations across the world, researchers have found carbon globs known as senospheres. And what these globs are they're microscopic spheres that only form when coal and crude oil burn. So it suggests that oil was burning in large amounts about 65 million years ago, just when the dinosaurs died out.
But somehow still would have spared our progenitors?
Exactly. The idea is it was a very devastating event, but not so devastating that it would have wiped out our ancestors, because clearly some creatures survived this devastation.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about a mysterious ring of Jupiter, how there might be dangerous levels of arsenic in baby rice, and finally, why female jumping spiders find ultraviolet rays sexy. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is the letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a response to the February 15th News Focus article, Wolves at the Door of a More Dangerous World. In that story, Virginia Morrell reports on the prospect of taking the Northern Rockies wolf population off the endangered species list. The concern is whether doing so would threaten the wolves' long-term demographic and genetic viability.
In the April 4th issue, Guillaume Chaperon and colleagues from the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences write in to suggest that, quote, viability should not be the sole objective of a species conservation plan. Another objective, often overlooked, should be to restore and maintain the ecological functionality of the species in its ecosystem.
In particular, the authors write, recent results from long-term research have shown that top predators can play some unexpected but nevertheless crucial roles in ecosystems. For example, they can indirectly support species lower down on the food chain, help restore vegetation, and even buffer some effects of climate change.
In sum, the authors write, conservation plans for predators should take this broader view of ecological roles into account, instead of focusing solely on a species' viability by numbers.
Also from the April 4th issue, a letter from Michael Aiken on disseminating science information. From the University of Arizona, Aiken writes in response to the January 18th story by Jocelyn Kaiser called Uncle Sam's Biomedical Archive Wants Your Papers.
In that story, Kaiser reports on a new law that means those funded by grants from the National Institutes of Health must submit copies of their accepted peer-reviewed manuscripts to the NIH for posting in a free online archive. Critics of the new law warn of copyright battles and troubles for scientists and journals.
Aiken writes, "Future historians of science may wonder what we were thinking." Instead, Aiken suggests two alternative paths to meet the goals of making research public without causing problems for scientists and journals.
Aiken writes, first, NIH could ensure that every NIH-funded study had to produce some public report. This would provide an outlet for results that had not been published through conventional channels within a reasonable time. Second, NIH could make publicly available the raw data of all funded studies within a reasonable time after the end of funding and with all appropriate documentation and protection of confidentiality.
Turning now to our April 11th issue, a letter and response about the word quaternary. The Quaternary is a geological period in which we are all living, roughly 1.8 million years ago, to the present. The letter and response were prompted by a January 25th News Focus by Richard Kerr, titled, A Time War Over the Period We Live In.
In that story, Kerr notes that stratigraphers would like to eliminate the Quaternary on the grounds that the boundaries of the Quaternary are not delineated by climate changes, violating a basic rule.
From Southern Methodist University, David Meltzer writes, how very odd, then, that the end of the Pleistocene, a unit that stratigraphers are happy to keep, is defined as exactly 10,000 carbon-14 years before present, near the end of the Younger Dryas cold spell. So, a chronologically arbitrary round number tied to the end of a merely millennium-long cold snap is somehow acceptable as a geological unit, but the climactically bounded quaternary is not? What am I missing?
From the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, William Berggren writes in that the 10,000 carbon-14 years before present, cited by Meltzer, is not a definition but a duration, and that scientists haven't officially defined that particular duration since it was established more than 40 years ago.
So, Berggren essentially suggests that everyone wait. He writes, these issues will be discussed at the forthcoming International Geological Congress in Oslo in August 2008. You can read their full exchange in the April 11th issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor for Science Magazine. If you enjoyed this letters segment of the podcast and would like to hear more, or have other comments about this segment or the podcast itself, please let us know. You can send your comments to our email address, sciencepodcast@aaas.org. And that wraps up the May 2nd, 2008 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.